Hi, everyone. I'm Sean Tui. I'm from Writer's Bone, a Boston-based podcast that deals with everything about writing. I'm really excited to be here again at the Boston Book Festival. I'm so happy everyone's here and enjoying wonderful food. Whatever you have, sir, looks delicious. Just, yes, I will. No one wants to hear me chewing. I don't want to hear myself chewing. Do want to hear myself talk, but we're not here for that today. Today, we're here to listen to four amazing memoir authors discuss their novel. We're going to do a short reading, and from there, we'll do a Q&A. So to start with our first author, it is, and I'm going to make sure we say their names correctly. I've been practicing for a few minutes. Adrienne Bordeaux is an award-winning author, editor with years of experience, a former acquisition editor. And Bordeaux has earned the National Magazine Award for Best Fiction 4 times. Her latest book,
Wild Game.
Wild Game. I just apologize.
That's okay.
This is what nervousness looks like, everyone. You may have seen her this week on the Today Show, and she's going to be our first reader today. So go ahead.
Okay. Thank you all so much for coming. It's really exciting. I recently moved to Cambridge just a few months ago, so I'm now officially a Bostonian myself. And I'm going to talk to you briefly about my memoir, Wild Game, subtitled My Mother, Her Lover, and Me. And it essentially tells the story of an incredibly pivotal moment in my life and the ripple effects of that moment. So the story starts, I'm telling you about the moment now, in 1980, on one of those incredibly hot summer nights in July. The book is set mostly on Cape Cod. It's after midnight, and I'm asleep upstairs in my bedroom. And at around midnight, I hear the door open, and my mother comes into my room, and she says, Rennie, which is my nickname, Rennie, wake up, wake up. And I remember not wanting to be roused. I was just not interested. And then she said, Ben Souther just kissed me. And with that, of course, my eyes blinked open. Because Ben Souther was my stepfather's best friend, and Ben Souther was married, which, of course, my mother was married. And these two couples were couple friends, and they'd been visiting for the weekend. And what I didn't know in that moment, when my mother woke me up to let me know that my stepfather's best friend had kissed her, was that this was going to go on. Did I mention that I was 14? That's an important point if I didn't. What I didn't know in this moment was that this would go on to be an epic love affair that would last over a decade. But what I did know, even in real time, was it was one of those moments with a before and an after. And I had gone to bed as my mother's daughter, and I had woken up as her confidant and best friend, and I would become a co-conspirator in this affair and sort of help her navigate it for the next 10 years of my life. So normally I read a little section from The Night She Woke Me Up, but I think because there are four of us and we all have stuff to share, I'm going to skip ahead and read to you from a part of the book that is when the affair is more in full swing. It's about a year later. It shows how involved I am. And I'm about 15. And what you need to know is my mother's name is Malabar. She was born in India. So Malabar is my mother. Her husband is Charles. And the friends, the lover is Ben Souther and his wife Lily. And the only other thing you know, there are two more things you need to know. Malabar is an astonishing, astonishing cook. She studied at Le Cordon Bleu. She wrote cookbooks my whole life. So there were always test dinners, we used to call them. My brother and I never had mac and cheese in our life, unfortunately. It was always something very gourmet. Her lover, Ben Souther, happened to be an avid recreational hunter and fisherman, hence the title of the book, Wild Game. So I'm going to read from, and my mother was always trying to figure out how to get more time. She was so in love with Ben Souther, and she kept wanting to figure out more time for them to be together and as these couple friends in order to make this relationship happen. So we're on Cape Cod. It's the fall. Nauset Harbor is in front of us. Oh, and Ben brought a big chunk of venison and venison liver. So Malabar was still in the kitchen when the rest of us put on jackets, went out into the crisp autumn air, and sat in a semicircle around the deck table, its center umbrella lowered and strapped for the season. The sun was making its descent behind us, casting long shafts of light across the harbor and creating the illusion that the marsh grass was on fire, glowing golden from beneath the surface of the water. From inside, the whir of the Cuisinart sounded as my mother blended the liver and vegetables, no doubt adding chunks of soft butter and salt flakes. Across the windswept bay, we heard terns screeching, and suddenly dozens materialized before us and dived towards some underwater disturbance. Then the surface of the water broke with a thrash of fins, what my father would call a bluefish blitz, and thousands of minnows leaped up to escape the fish hunting them from below, only to be snatched up in the beaks of black-capped terns above. I studied Ben as he observed the carnage. His body twitched the way some men's bodies do when they watch a football game, imagining that they are catching the pass. I could tell he would have liked to grab a rod and dash down to the water, which is what my father would have done. But instead, hearing the rapping on the glass slider, he turned to help my mother, who stood on the other side holding a large, round serving board. They beamed at each other as she slipped past. The birds dispersed, and their feeding frenzy ended as ours began. Malabar lowered the artfully arranged pre-dinner offerings. Paper-thin slices of ruby-red venison carpaccio under dollops of horseradish creme fraiche, a bowl of wrinkled and briny olives, two triangles of overly ripe cheese oozing past their soft rinds, and a dish of her ethereally smooth venison pâté tucked in beside a collection of cornichons and slices of pickled onions. The tray was a thing of beauty, each delicacy separated by sprigs of rosemary from my mother's herb garden and garnished with lily's nasturtium flowers. Malabar admired her handiwork and let loose a hearty laugh. "If something on this board doesn't kill us, I'm not sure what will," she said, raising her glass. "To salmonella." "To legionnaires," Charles toasted. I raised my glass and took a big swig of ginger ale. "Bring on the bacteria," Ben said, taking hold of Malabar's free hand. He kissed her palm. "Malabar, I can think of no better way to go than to be poisoned by you." The ice-cold soda got stuck on a knot of remorse in the back of my throat. Lily registered my distress by rolling her eyes at me, a look I took to mean, "I'm not worried, so don't you be. Pay no attention to these old fools." Seeing Lily's lack of concern, I relaxed a bit. Still, something on my face had given away my concern, and I felt sick that Lily had seen it. "Stupid," I chided myself, and I willed Ben and Malabar to be less obvious. My mother spread generous scoopfuls of venison pâté over thin slices of toasted and buttered French bread and placed one round onto each of our open palms as if bestowing the host at communion. We popped them whole into our mouths. The flavors and textures settled over our tongues as the whipped and gamey layers revealed themselves in slow motion. "Heavenly," Ben said, his words muffled around his mouthful. Charles nodded. "Wait, everyone. I have an idea," my mother announced dramatically, bringing her hands down on the table. I perked up. This was my cue. My mother and I had practiced how to mortar each brick into this storyline, and it was critical to get Charles and Lily on board. This conversation could not be solely my mother and Ben. That wouldn't look good. My role was crucial. Malabar took a leisurely, palate-cleansing sip of her power pack, which, by the way, is her nickname for a dry Manhattan. Her audience leaned in. "What do you think about," she paused here for effect, "a wild game cookbook?" I took another sip of ginger ale and waited a beat. Charles's eyebrows lifted in contemplation. He was no doubt imagining what the next year of test dinners might promise. He'd been enjoying the fruits of Malabar's labor with her do-ahead dining column, but this had not always been the case. Early in their marriage, my mother had agreed to put together a charity cookbook for the middle school that my brother and I attended. The other parents, decidedly unsophisticated cooks, submitted recipes, and for one very long year, Malabar tested the gelatinous one-dish casseroles. Charles would arrive home in the evening, take a look at my mother hunched over the stove, the telltale red notebook on its stand, and cringe. Sweet, no, not another test night. What exactly counts as wild game, I ask now. Sounds a bit gross, just meat, meat, and more meat. Oh, Rennie, not at all, my mother said. Our cookbook can be whatever we want it to be. It should definitely include seafood. Just look at the bounty out there. And vegetables, the type you can forage for. Lily, you could teach me about mushrooming. Lily smiled at the thought of having a role. But who would buy it, I said, playing devil's advocate, my tone hinting that the adults were out of touch. Not everyone has a hunter in their midst. You guys are the exception here, not the rule. All this, I pointed to the tray of appetizers, is not exactly normal. Normal, my dear, my mother said in her most regal voice, is not something I've ever aspired to. Okay, fine, you're not normal, Mom, but like not one kid at my school eats pheasant or rabbit. There will be 10 people who will buy this book. I disagree, Rennie, Lily said. I exhaled. She had taken the bait. Think of all the people who are becoming dismayed by the food industry these days with how we raise meat in this country, she continued, the chemicals, the pesticides, the condition. Hook, line, sinker. My mother blinked love my way, Morse code style, and Ben tapped his knee against mine under the table. Brilliant idea, sweet, Charles said to my mother, and he reminded us that all of his children love to fish and hunt. Count me in. Do we have a title? Asked Charles. Ben and my mother were silent for a moment. They looked upward as if a title might fall from the sky. How about something simple, Malabar said. We could call it Wild Game. It tells the reader what to expect, but promises adventure too. It's perfect, Lily said. Ben touched his glass to my mother's, to our Wild Game, Malabar. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. On to our next author, Susan Lewis Salamont, whose name caused me so much anxiety last night. Glad I was able to say it. Has a wonderful book, Lost and Found in Spain, which covers her years working with her husband, who was the U.S. ambassador to Spain, meeting famous chefs and finding her way through a new community. She's going to read an excerpt from her book now.
Thanks, Sean, and thank you to everybody for being here. I thought only my friends Amy and Alice sitting up front and Meryl in the back were going to be here, so I really appreciate this. So in 2009, President Obama asked my husband to be his ambassador to Spain and Andorra, and to support him and serve our country, I moved to Spain, and together we entered the world of diplomacy. It was a world where my husband was the equivalent of a four-star general. His name carried with it the title of extraordinary and plenipotentiary, and mine was spouse. Hence the adventure begins. So I'm going to read a little bit. It's called Lost and Found in Spain, Tales of an Ambassador's Wife. I'm going to read a little bit about why I was lost and why I was found. But for the sake of time, you're not going to hear about Antonio Banderas or Rafa Nadal or Leonard Cohen or any of the other wonderful people who came to visit us along the way. But I hope that you will also hear how proud I am that I've gotten to serve my country, how proud it was to work under President Obama and walk through the streets of Spain where people would come up to me and say, I love your president. So. And of course, I lost my first bookmark. So, the lost part. In July 2009, Alan and I ventured to Washington, D.C. to participate in ambassador school. It's the Department of State's mandatory ambassadorial seminar. It's also lovingly referred to as charm school. And trust me, there's nothing charming about it. First of all, it's long and grueling. 12 ambassador designates and their spouses met from 8:30 in the morning till 6 in the evening, Monday through Friday, for 2 solid weeks. The government officials filtered in and out of our room, telling us about the roles we would play overseas, and also teaching us about what felt like alphabet soup, some of which is familiar, the CIA, the DOS, the RSO, the FBI. I threw myself into the curriculum. I took copious notes, and I tried to keep all of the agencies and their various functions straight. It was like being in college again, subjected to rigorous immersion in the workings of our government, both in our nation's capital and in the embassies, consulates, and diplomatic missions around the world. We learned about our countries, the structures. I'm going to run through this here quickly. We learned the basics. I learned the basics of Spain's government. There are 17 autonomous regions. It was at that point the world's largest, ninth largest economy, and it was headed towards a terrible recession caused by overdevelopment in real estate and overextension by the banking industry. The seminar's days were fascinating and educational, but also nerve-wracking. The idea of moving abroad and representing the United States in Spain was becoming alarmingly real. And the words conflict of interest popped up in a conversation with one of the government officials, as in jobs for spouses of ambassadors are often deemed to represent a conflict of interest. I won't editorialize, okay? You can use your own imaginations. That's right. According to the Department of State, the risk exists that ambassadors might use their official position to benefit an employer or a client. The government did not want me to work, nor did they want me to have any positions on any of the foundations or on the boards that I served and derived great satisfaction. So I thought, at least I would be exchanging my professional commitments for meaningful work at the embassy, right? Not so. My first inkling of the diminutive role of ambassador's spouse came when our instructors circulated to each participant a loose leaf binder with important information and resources, including the resume and the curriculum vitae of every ambassador present. I was immediately struck by the realization that the binder's contents contained nothing about any of the ambassador's spouses. A bit vexed, I began to wonder what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the most powerful woman in the United States at that time, and certainly the most famous political spouse, would say. Surely she would not approve of this glaring omission. I'm going to fast forward to when we arrived in Spain in January 2010. I went around to every department or section, as they are known in embassies, and offered my services. Everyone was incredibly polite to me. They thanked me, and they promised they would call me, but they didn't. I took this rejection to heart. How could nobody want me? I'm good, I'm smart, I'm capable. And I told myself that everyone was busy with demanding jobs. But I couldn't deny that receiving the brush off from everyone was frustrating and incomprehensible. Everyone in the Foreign Service, from the ambassador, whose official title included the words extraordinary and plenipotentiary, had a role to play. Yet I was a little bit more than an accessory to my husband, with no official role and seemingly of little professional value. I'll leave it there for a second or two to go on to say I found a meaningful role. I traveled throughout Spain. A lot of that is written up here. We're not the ambassador to just a capital city, but you're the ambassador to a country. I learned a lot about what our embassies do abroad, and I hope the book will dispel myths that people just go to teas and wear long dresses and entertain. We did hard work from sunup, which in Spain, believe it or not, is at 7 in the morning, till sundown, which on a good night is 11, 12 at night, but dinner doesn't end till 1 or 2 in the morning. And every day we woke up saying, how could we best serve the United States and create bonds with Spain and our country in the best of ways? The book will describe a lot of the meaningful work I did, including really shining a light on the important work women in Spain do. heads of companies that are too numerous to list here, but they'll talk about them in the book. I talk about the food. You'll read about Jose Andres. You'll read about Ferran Adria. You'll read about all the great wine. You will go out and you will shop excessively now because everything's going to be tariffed and by the end of the month. But let me just fast forward, and I hope I have time here, to, I have 1 minute to when I was found. So I'm going to skip a lot because I only have 1 minute. So it ends with us meeting with a goodbye audience with the king and the queen of Spain, as well as with the prince and the princess, who are now the king and queen, who told us how much they love our country, how much they love our president again, and how what a great job we did. But I went back because I was hosting a luncheon for 100 women in Spain. We had to ride through the streets with our embassy flashlights, you know, like the car, the motorcade going through the streets. And I arrived at our residence to find 100 women already seated for lunch. Ana Botella, the mayor of Madrid, was in attendance, as were panelists from my women's leadership forums, guests that I had hosted for philanthropy roundtables, journalists who had interviewed me, and dear friends who had welcomed me into their homes. I could identify each and every one and tell a story about how we all connected. After lunch, something more amazing happened than the standing ovation I got when I walked in the room. As we were sitting having lunch, one woman started to sing, and soon the whole room joined in. The song was in Spanish, and everyone seemed to know the words. The title, Algo se muere en el alma cuando una amiga se va, translates to something like, your soul dies when a friend leaves. The lyrics go on to convey heartfelt thanks to a friend. 100 amazing, inspirational women were publicly acknowledging my efforts in Spain and demonstrating how much I would be missed. I was speechless. I doubt I will ever again experience such a humbling, thoughtful, and grand gesture of friendship. All written in here, plus a lot more adventures. And I'd be remiss if I didn't plug Stella the Ambassador Dog for children ages 3 to 8, written about my dog who became the Ambassador Dog, and she had adventures too. It will be released next month. Thank you.
Wonderful. Our next author is also a local author. Maureen Cavanaugh's novel, If You Love Me, is a brutally honest coverage of her journey with her daughter down the road of recovery and opioid addiction. She has a few words to say, and Maureen.
Thank you. Thank you all for taking the time to listen to me. This always shocks me that there's actually people that want to listen to my story. It's been really an amazing experience. The book has been out for about a year now. When I was very young, maybe 7 or 8, I used to write stories and illustrate them and staple them together and then sell them door to door for a quarter. I was the most annoying child on University Drive, I can promise you that. I always loved to write, mostly fiction, and I, like many people, dreamed of being published one day. But a memoir was never, ever on my list of things to write. As in an Irish Catholic family where we were told not to ever speak about anything, my nickname was Miss Closed Mouth. So this, the idea that I was going to write a memoir wasn't on anybody's radar. I'm an ordinary person, too, so again, no reason for a memoir. But ordinary in the age of the opioid epidemic means that my daughter became addicted to heroin, overdosed to the point of death more than 13 times, and entered more than 40 treatment centers. My Katie is smart and funny and kind and empathetic, and I find that describes too many of the people that we are losing to overdose, the people without that hard outer shell, the people we need in this world. I wrote this book in hopes that others, like me, would see it and see that they weren't alone, because the shame and stigma involved in this disease is an isolating experience. But I realized when that first box of books was delivered to my house, and I opened it up, and my entire life was in there, and every horrible thing that had happened was in there, I realized that I also wrote it for people that had not had this experience in hopes that they would read the story and maybe understand what parents go through, what families that are involved in this crisis, and the people that they love, that these children are loved and family members are loved, and love their families too. And I hoped it would bring people together to open doors and create change. All of these things have happened, I'm happy to say. So I'd like to read the prologue from the book. And is anybody going to be horribly upset if I curse maybe once or twice? Because if you don't curse when you're going through this, there's something seriously wrong with you. First, I want to preface this by saying I'm a special education teacher. I am not like a boxer or a cage fighter or anything, but I'm not sure how I get into the car, but I know I'm on my way to kill Bob. I don't want to take my eyes off the road because I'm feeling unsteady, and it's important I get there. I don't want to miss him. A few minutes can make all the difference. I can see in my mind's eye the bat cracking across his skull. I won't stop there. I will beat him, a man twice my size, in front of whoever is there, despite his cries for mercy, over and over, until he stops moving, stops crying out, stops destroying my beautiful Katie. I won't quit until he isn't breathing. Then I will spit on him, something I've never even considered doing to anyone in my 54 years of life. I will do all of this, and I will never have a moment's guilt over it. I reach over and touch the top of the bat. This is long overdue. The calm exterior that the world sees is about to shatter. The last chain of events has broken something. I know what I need to do, and I can't remember the last time during this horror show of the past 2 years when I was so clear about anything. So many unanswered questions, so many late night pleas to God, so many theories about what I did wrong. It's a relief to finally have an answer, even this one. I feel as though the bat is begging to kill Bob. It's my son Liam's bat, the golden child, his brothers and sisters half call him half-jokingly. It's been so very long since I felt anything other than heartbroken that I'm pretty convinced it's never been any other way. I look down at my body, 20 pounds heavier. The doctor has warned me about that 2 years ago when I started to take the 50 milligrams of Zoloft for the paralyzing anxiety that looked a lot like sadness. But somehow, the weight still snuck up on me. It's not the small pill causing the gains, I know that. It's my secret relationship with Ben and Jerry, my boyfriends. Nothing other than peanut butter cup will do, and I've hunted through store after store until I find it. Then I go home, climb into bed, watch a sitcom with a laugh track, and comfort myself with on-demand mindlessness and empty calories. It could be worse, I tell myself. I know this is true, because I've seen much, much worse. I've seen so much pain in the last few years, I hadn't known just how much pain the world could contain. It crushes me sometimes, not just my own pain, but the pain of so many others trying to hang on to whatever shred of love of their loved ones they can. I don't know how I got here. There is never a day that goes by that this does not feel surreal. I can't save my daughter, Katie, and sometimes that feels like the only certainty in my life. I can't make her stop using drugs any more than I could keep her from leaving any of the over 40 treatment centers she has left, or safeguard her from the double-digit number of overdoses. I've finally come to the realization that there is nothing I can say or do that will make a difference. She's going to leave the facility she's in now, and I know that because she called and told me so. I tried to talk her out of it, saying all of the things I've said 100 times before, the things that have helped 100 people before her, but I could hear the venom in her voice. Some switches flipped, and she's ready to run. Not the first time, but I know it could be the last. This will be one of several treatment centers where she's been doing well, and she decides to leave, courtesy of a 56-year-old piece of shit named Bob. I'm drifting to one side of the road when my phone rings and snaps me back to attention. I hope for a brief second that it will be the call, the one I've dreamed about, that will tell me this is all a mistake, nothing to worry about, go home and eat your ice cream. And when I realize that isn't happening, I wonder briefly if people on the way to kill someone answer the phone. There really isn't a rule book or protocol for this, so I reach for it and study the name of the caller. I finished writing this book when my daughter was 3 days out of her last treatment center. Of course, I didn't know it would be her last program at that time, and if history was any indicator of the future, she would be either in treatment again or overdosing within the week, most likely both. People that cared about me told me to get ready because my story was not going to have a happy ending. They were trying to save me from that brutal shock. But Instead, 3 months later, we celebrated her 25th birthday. After a few more months, she had a cat, an apartment, and was planning on going back to school. She had 2 jobs and a car by the time she had a year in recovery. And this past July, we celebrated 2 years, and she just graduated from school 2 weeks ago. This is a kid that almost everyone gave up on. This is my story, and the story of the creation of a national nonprofit and peer support group I founded called Magnolia New Beginnings. We now have over 25,000 members, mostly moms, I'm sorry to say. We've got to get those dads in there, too. And it's a source of comfort and support, and education for many people. It's also the story of those many families across the country that are sharing a similar experience. And I really hope that if you're going to read this book, that you walk away with a better understanding of what families are going through if you don't already know, and that you'll laugh a little, because without a very dark, odd sense of humor, which I carry throughout this book, I promise it's funny, I don't think I could have gotten through this. That, an enormous amount of hope. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. And our last reading of the day, William Dameron, is an award-winning blogger and essayist. His Modern Love article was just picked as one of the top 25 by Modern Love. And his first book, The Lie, which you'll be reading from today, was picked as an editor's choice by the New York Times.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you all for being here. And I'm loud. I'm going to stand up, too, because I don't read well. When I sit down, and I'm afraid I'm going to fall back on these weird little chairs. A few years ago, I received an email from a woman I had never met, and the first line was, "Your face has meant a lot to me, but now I've found out it's a lie." She went on to describe how she had a 4-year online relationship with somebody who used my pictures to catfish her. And when I did a reverse image search, I found out my face was synonymous with the search phrase 40-year-old white man. And she was not the only one who had been catfished. There have been countless women. I've heard from about 15. And it was like the universe was calling me out, because for my life, I had pretended to be somebody I was not. I was a gay man married to a straight woman. So this memoir, The Lie, is me looking back on that life through the lens of catfishing. But in honor of the Modern Love column, and thank you for mentioning that, Sean, I'm going to read an excerpt from my book that became the Modern Love column. And it was called, "After 264 Haircuts, a Marriage Ends." Catherine lofted the black cape as I watched it billow in front of me like a sheet blossoming on a clothesline. She fastened the buttons around my neck, placed her hands on either side of my head, and whispered, "I can't do this anymore." "Do what?" I asked. "This," she said, gesturing around us. "I have to let you go." Still, she reached into a black case and pulled out scissors and a comb. The scent of freshly cut grass drifted through an open kitchen window, along with the squeals of neighborhood children. "Who will cut your hair?" she asked. I shrugged my shoulders. For more than 22 years, roughly 264 haircuts, we had shared this ritual. She would run her hands through my hair, nudging my head forward and sideways, her fingers mere inches away from the secret thoughts and desires swirling inside of my skull. She pulled up a swath of hair with a comb and began to snip. When we first met in the 1980s, I wore my hair parted on the side, a preppy, conservative look. On our second date, she swept back my bangs with her fingertips and offered to cut my hair for the first time. Over the years, clumps of my dark hair have slid down the cape and pooled on the kitchen floor. Eventually, the side part vanished, and flecks of gray started to mingle with the black. Now the hair that fell was mostly gray, peppered with a few black strands. "Do you have the clippers?" I asked. She reached into the case and pulled out the heavy walls. When she turned them on, they emitted a low electronic buzz. "Cut it all off," I said. "What?" she replied. I want you to buzz it all off. If I didn't have any here, it wouldn't matter that I no longer had her to cut it. Go on, do it. I watched the hair tumble onto the cape, her breast pressed against my shoulder, and her hand brushed the hair from my head. And then I felt something wet fall on my cheek. I heard a sound, like a hiccup, and then I heard it again, but it was more like a sucking noise, like someone trying to catch a breath. Her tears began to fall like clumps of hair. "Shh, it's okay," I said. She stood back, her face red and blotchy. "It's just that you look so different now." She held up a mirror and I winced. "Oh, man," I said. There was something honest and bold about the look. "Shave off the rest." "But you'll look like a cancer patient. It's just hair." She finished. And as if my thoughts had been laid bare too, she said, "You know, Bill, I'm stronger now. I can make it on my own." "I know that," I said. For 2 months, ever since I moved out, we have been engaged in a weekend dance of me visiting to keep contact with our girls, staying at home in our home in Virginia as if nothing had changed. But everything had changed. She rubbed the lotion on my neck and pulled out a straight razor. I felt the cool metal on my skin as she nudged my head forward and down with her fingertips. I closed my eyes. I could hear our 14-year-old daughter chattering on the telephone and laughter coming from the TV. Our dog's claws clicked across the floor. "I didn't cheat on you," I said, keeping my head down and my eyes closed. The blade stood still for a moment, and then she skimmed down the back of my neck. "I had to get that HIV test," she said, "because you were acting so out of character." I was offended when she first told me this. How many times had we made love? Was it greater or fewer than the number of haircuts? Of course the test was negative. I could count on one hand the number of people I had been intimate with before her. The first was my childhood neighbor in Greensboro, North Carolina. He and I were too young to understand our dark fumblings during sleepovers. In college, I lost my virginity to Sally, a red-haired flute player, and a rite of passage that I just simply wanted to get over. When I was 20 in Colorado for the summer with my Aunt Sheila and her psychic girlfriend, I stumbled out of a bar on the edge of town walking arm in arm with Don, my aunt's handsome young friend. Under the shadow of Pike's Peak, he and I kissed. I heard Sheila's voice in the distance calling out, "He's not sure if he's gay yet, Don." But I knew. When I first started seeing Catherine at 21, I told her about Sally, but not about Don. That part of my life was supposed to have been erased by conversion therapy, which involved with me praying with my mother at the dining room table every day not to be the way I was. The first time Catherine and I had sex was on a sofa in my brother's off-campus apartment in Raleigh, North Carolina. Neither of us was a virgin, so there was no awkward fumbling, just as there was no passionate taboo. I recognized it for what it was. This was as good as it could get. For more than 22 years after our daughters were born, and as my hair became grayer and Catherine's body became softer, I kept my secret locked away. Then, on a Wednesday night, 10 years ago, in a Walmart parking lot, Catherine saved me. "Are you gay?" she asked. "I don't want to be," I said. "Oh, God," she replied. Shortly after our marriage ended, but while I was still making my weekend visits, there was Ray. On our second date, I ripped the clothing from his body. Afterward, he held up his pants and examined the broken zipper and popped button. "Those were my favorite pants," he said. I laughed. He did not. "We're done," Catherine said. She brushed the hair from my shoulders and removed the cape. I stood up, put on my shirt, and pulled the broom from the kitchen closet to sweep up. When the girls went to bed, I wandered the house, taking stock of the things that were no longer mine. There on the dining room table was the blue metal pitcher we found in an antique shop in New Hampshire. This painting above the mantle was my 20th wedding anniversary gift to her. Here was the sofa where Catherine and I once lay side by side with a sleeping dog at our feet. The wooden floors creaked as I passed. When I reached the top of the stairs, Catherine stood motionless in the dark hall. "Can I sleep with you? Just sleep this one last night," I asked. "Don't wake me in the morning," she said. She removed her nightgown. I took off my shirt. That was her side of the bed, and this used to be mine. Here was a blue comforter where we cradled our newborn girls. These were the pillows flattened with use. I lay awake on my back. She rested her hand on my neck. I turned to my right side, and she to her left as we twisted in our bittersweet ballet of goodbye. In the grainy morning light, I closed the bedroom door and tiptoed to my daughter's room. This was Olivia's. Those were the boxes filled with her dolls. I tucked her dark hair behind her ear and kissed her warm cheek. Here was Claire's. These were her glasses. I picked them up and cleaned them with the tail of my shirt. "I'm just going to work now," I muttered, a half-truth in the half-light. This behind me was a house full of secrets, and here before me was the path that lay ahead. This is what I left. An empty chair at the dining room table, the scent of my skin on the sheets, an old painting, a sleeping dog, a blue picture, my lingering shadow on the front steps before I let go. Thank you.
That was amazing. Thank you, all of our authors. Everyone, give them a round of hands. That's really difficult. Reading a book in public is hard, but also exposing, you know, heavy moments in your life. So most writers have to deal with, you know, heavy emotional moments, but they're make-believe. You guys are writing things that actually happen, and you're telling it to the public. How, you know, reliving these moments, does it help anyone? Does it? Do you look back on it? Do you relive it? What does it do to you as a person and also as a writer?
A lot of people ask, they say, it must have been therapy to write that book. I don't feel that way. I don't subscribe to that. For me, I'm a writer. I wanted to write a story that people would love and that had plot, and it was like a novel. And so that was important to me. But I also wanted to tell a story that people would remember. And my story is that it's never too late to become who you were meant to be. And so for me, that's what this book is about. And once I've written it, it's sort of outside of me. And it's a story on its own. And so when I read it, I want to do justice to the story, not to my memory.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I wrote this book hoping that I would create change, that I would change people's mind about who gets involved with drugs, who are the people we're losing, 72,000 people a year we're losing, who those people are. And I hope that by telling my story, you would be able to see that, because there's many other stories in here of other people that were at death's door, really, and they're all in recovery right now. I hope people would find hope in this book, too, and that's really why I felt like I used myself as a vehicle to tell those stories.
I think my book's a little bit different than everyone else's because you've all dealt with some really amazing life experiences that had to put you through a lot of emotional roller coaster. I had a pretty good roller coaster. I mean, I was living in Spain. While I was lost in terms of who I was not hurting in the same way of the pain that you have all gone through. So therefore, for me, every time I'm up here, I relive it, and I know that there's more found been lost, and it's really very joyful, and I'm very proud of the experience we've had. Yeah.
And for me, I think anyone who's had, who's lived a life that has involved keeping secrets, which we all know is a very corrosive, difficult thing, because when you keep a profound secret, it keeps you from being known. And I think for the longest time, I tried to tamp it down, and the more you deny your story, the more it takes hold of you, and the more it owns you. And in some ways, it was confronting it and looking at it. And for me, anyway, the game changer was also starting a family of my own, realizing that if I didn't heal from this, I might transmit it. This was sort of an inherited, there was a legacy of secrets in my family, and I just wanted to make sure it stopped with my generation, with me, and not went going on to my children.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. I always like to ask that question. I bet plenty of people here have questions, so the floor is now open. If you have a question, please, you can form in front of the microphone. Anyone? Takers?
They're running.
No one? I have dozens of questions. Oh, we have a question back here.
I had written a series of letters when I lived in Spain called Olas.
Yeah, sorry. Oh. Let me repeat the question. Wonderful question asking if our authors had a support system around them while writing these memoirs.
So I wrote a series of letters when I lived in Spain. Somebody's putting their hand out that they can't hear. I'll try to hold that better. And those were my ways of communicating with people while I was overseas. They went to 13 people by Ola number one, and then they went to 3,000 people by the end of my tenure in Spain. And when I came back and was encouraged to put them in a book, I was given some very good advice, which is a book of letters is not a book. At least my book of letters was not a book. So I worked with a writing coach. I worked with somebody that pushed me to really delve deep into these stories. And without his guidance, I think it would have been a lot more solitary experience for me, and I think I would still be writing this book. The editing part was fun, but to really probe and tell a story that's worth telling, I found I don't work well alone. I needed that kind of partnership, and I don't want to call him a partner in this, but somebody who pushed me.
I did mostly write this book alone. I mean, what I will say is if there was a community, it was a community of literature, and every book I'd ever read and reading wonderful memoirs. And the fact is, reading is such an empathetic act because if you're reading well and you're enjoying a book, you are really involved in the lives of characters and you're watching them get through their own complicated situations. And I think that was very helpful for me. I did have people in my life, obviously, who knew I was doing this and were supportive, writer friends and so on. But, the writing act itself is quite a lonely endeavor and very different from something like this.
I think I have kind of of course, I have an odd experience. I was contacted by an agent to write the book through somebody at the New York Times who had written multiple articles, had written two articles about me and what I was doing with the nonprofit. And he wanted her to write it with me, but she couldn't write it because it was a conflict of interest. So I approached him and I said, I'd like to write the book. And I could hear his eyes rolling over the phone. And I said, no, really, I can write. So he said, well, send me 10 pages. I'm sure he figured he'd never hear from me again. And I sent him 10 pages, and he called me right away and said, send five questions, 2 pages each. And I sent that. He said, okay, you can write the book. And he was an enormous support system, but I was going through all of this with my daughter, so I think I wrote it very much by myself, and I would send him off chapters and... And that's kind of, I think it's a different experience than most people have.
My support was online. I started a blog because I couldn't find my story in the world. And so I said, I'm going to write it myself. I'm going to write blog posts. And it started with the happy stuff, the stuff that came after I came out. So it was just little vignettes about my life with my now husband. And so little by little, I published those in different venues, in the Huffington Post and Boston Globe and different places, and it just built up to, oh, maybe I can write a book. And That was pretty solitary, though. I did take online classes. I took classes at Grub Street and also at Gotham Writers Workshop in New York, which was fantastic.
Thank you.
That was a great question. Thank you. Yes.
I am a newspaper editor, and I have occasionally dabbled in very small little bits of memoir, like a column or something. But I wrote something last year about my mother, who had just turned 90, and I did not show it to any of my sisters. She has memory issues, like many 90-year-olds. Didn't show it to any of my sisters. Kind of didn't think they'd see it. But of course they did. And two of them were quite unhappy with me. So I am just, and I, you know, wrote it very, thinking about that a lot and very careful about what things I included and what things I didn't include. So I have that question, both how you know what it's okay to include when you're writing something deeply personal about the people in your lives, and also whether you clear it with anybody or, you know, can you write about your former wife without checking in with her?
Yeah, that was a huge concern of mine because the people who were closest to me I had to write about, they went through it with me, my ex-wife, my daughters. I had to write about them. I could not include them. The modern love piece I did send to my ex-wife and had her read it, and there was a section she was uncomfortable with, and it was too big in that little space. It took up too much emotional space, and so I took it out, and I didn't include it, and I thought it would fall apart, but it didn't. The book itself, there were two legal reviews. The attorney had to make sure everything was accurate and that everybody was okay with it. So I had to reach out to everybody and let them know what I was going to write about them, not that I was going to send them the book and that they had line item veto. I was not going to do that. While I was writing it, I wrote everything, and I pretended nobody would ever read it. Ann Hood said to me, write the thing that you are most afraid to say, and once you do that, you gain power over the truth. And so that's what I did, and I always knew there would be time later to edit it.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of a concern, there were several things that were already in the paper about my experience, so I felt like some of the more painful things were already out there, and it was my story, and I really felt like it was a story that needed to be told. So the that kind of superseded anybody else's problems with it, but that's not to say that people didn't have problems with it. But those things, people will get over those things. The most importantly, my daughter has read the book like 5 times, and she's incredibly proud of it. And that was really the most important thing to me, that she was okay with it.
I offended 2 people, and one of them was one of my daughters. And it was my other daughter who pointed out to me that this might be offensive to her. And it was in my trying to be honest about her difficulty. So I really had to go back, it was before it was published, I had to go back and re-edit that because she's one of the last people in the world I would want to offend. And I appreciated hearing that. I didn't think it was an offensive comment, it just talked about some of her difficulty with the situation. And she said to me, it's not your story to tell, it's mine. So I took that to heart. And then there's one person in the book that I really would have liked to offended more. Because she wasn't very nice. She wasn't kind. And I decided I'd take the high road. And I was a diplomat. You're supposed to take the high road.
Yeah.
So I think if anybody really knew the situation, they could read between the lines and figure out who it was. But I'd wanted to take a higher road in the tale I was telling.
Yeah. And I think that's very important. I think, settling a score in a memoir, you just look bad. It's not the point of it. In my own case, I did talk to the people. I let them know about 5 years ago who I was most concerned about. And what I should say is that the news of the affair, like I wasn't outing anyone. This was old news. The bigger news was my involvement. And I was very interested in examining my role in this and how destructive it was for me and why I stayed involved for as long as I did. And I think the last thing that I'll say on this topic is, you know, I'm going to botch this quote, and I think it's Sylvia Plath, but it is, you know, of course, it's the reader's right to interpret. I mean, that is absolutely the reader's right, but it often says more about the interpreter than what's being interpreted. We know what books we wrote, but we can't help that that might be a different book than the one you read.
That was wonderful. Thank you for that question. That was great. I'm going to take the last question. So if anyone has one more question they really want to ask, this is the time.
She called time, Sean.
Oh, no, it's time. Oh, that was so great. Everyone, please give it for our authors. That was amazing. You guys are phenomenal. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. Take a stand. Thank you, everybody.